Great having you today. We are just at the beginning of our all church journey. Every year we take a look at what is the one thing that if we all center down on it and learn, it will be the best for our spiritual development. So if you're here for the first time or been around for a while, you're a part of the most important thing Crossroads does every year. And this year, we're starting to take a look at what actually is Jesus about? Who is he? What if we reset our assumptions of him, whatever those might be inside of this room? I thought those were interesting, those different pictures up there. Probably not all that surprising in a city that heavily Catholic city that B would be very popular. I was surprised, however, that nobody picked D, that is the most Middle Eastern looking Jesus, which certainly Jesus was from the Middle East. No one picked D. I thought that was interesting. I also thought that was interesting for myself, which I'll talk about a bit later today, how C, how most people saw, or a lot of people saw that as Jesus. And personally, I wrestle with that. I wrestle with believing that Jesus wants to nurture and take care of me. And I'll talk about that, and that's part of why I need to hit the reset button personally. Well, here's what a journey looks like. You're here at the service, so that's step one. Step two is when you go home, we've given you all a little booklet. Everyone pull up your little booklet there and fan your neighbor right there. Fan your neighbor. Beautiful. We'd like you to keep this with you all journey long. Bring this in to the different services. Take notes in here. There's personal work for you to do at home. Also, you'll be taking this to your small group experience that you have again for 6 weeks. If you're not in a small group, no worries yet. No worries. Crossroads is a last minute culture. If you're not in one yet, you're just you're with a high percentage of our church. But if you're already in one, raise your hand. How many of us are already in? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. All right. Now, here's how you get into a small group if you're not one in one already. First of all, you can go to the Connect event. That's tonight, 7:30. Just show up here and we'll get you connected in one. If you're a host and you have extra spots in your group, come and recruit for your group right then and there tonight. Also, you can still go to crossroads.net/reset. That was last year's journey. Consume. Reset. And still get into one electronically. You can also come to an on-site group Wednesday night. Just show up here or up in the northern part of the city. The Mason folks, the Mason site of Crossroads will be meeting at Living Leaf Church. I don't know where that is, but it's alive and it's a leaf up north. So you can go there. They're being very generous, letting us use their building for on-site groups. You can go there. Also, if you got kids in Kids Club, they'll have one of these for you to do a little reset discussion with your kids. I think that's great, but if you're an adult, please don't substitute this for your small group because there's some intense, awesome conversation you'll have with people who are more on your level intellectually. Though for some of us. All right. I'm really honored you got here today, especially with the snow. Is there snow out there right now? No, not for this group, is there? We laugh at stinking snow. Yes, we do. Well, before we go any further, let me pray for us. God, I'm thankful for today. I'm thankful for every life that's here. I'm thankful that everyone here didn't have an accident getting here. And I'm thankful that you actually came here, Jesus. I am thankful for that. A lot of us in here don't believe that or are unsure of that. And so I'm just thankful that they're here. And I know no matter where we are in our current spiritual orientation, you can reach us, you can teach us, and we're praying you do that starting today. Amen. You know, one of the struggles we're going to have in this, and people have this in every single walk of life in our country, is the desire to be original or the desire to be true. All of us, I believe, have the desire to be original. We want to be a one of a kind. Myself, I struggle with this. I want to be original. Maybe that's part of why I liked wearing fuzzy Crocs, because I think that no other pastor in America is probably wearing these on stage right now. Probably nobody else is. And so maybe I... You want that, huh? Yeah, yeah. Maybe I'm drawn to that because I want to be original. Maybe all of us just, we want to believe we're special. Our parents told us, you know, you're special. Let me tell you something. You're not. I'm sorry. You're not special. You're not. You're unique, but you're not special. You're unique. All of us are unique, but we want to be original, like nobody else like us. And so this is one of the reasons why I think a lot of theories exist about Jesus, is because you always got to find a new, different theory. This is why I get confused when I read anything about personal health. You ever notice how contradictory so many articles are about health? Like when I was in grade school, we had the balanced pyramid that said this is what you should eat, have three balanced meals. And then there's articles that come out and say, no, that pyramid's wrong. It was heavily influenced by the dairy industry and the lobbyists. You shouldn't be having that much dairy. And then some people write articles and say you ought to have three balanced meals, whatever they are. Other people come out and write an article and say, no, you ought to have six smaller portions throughout the day. Other people come out and say, hey, you should just eat whenever you're hungry. That's how God has created us. And all of these contradictory things that are happening. And then when it comes to working out, you have people say, well, you got to do 30 minutes, three times a week of aerobic exercise. Some people say, no, 45 minutes. Other people say, no, if you're a man, you got the testosterone thing going. You got to lean into testosterone. Don't do any aerobics. Just do actual weightlifting. And then you hear people, some people say, well, stress is bad for you. It leads to ulcers. It cuts your life short. And then in Newsweek, this last week, the front page article in Newsweek was, stress is good for you. Call me a cynic, but I swear the reason all these different articles come up is because they realize if they don't say something different, no one is going to publish them and they won't make money. So if I don't say something new, something that's controversial, no one will pay me. And it seems like we're all more interested in being original than we are in actually knowing what the truth is. Maybe you're resisting an image of Jesus because there's somebody a couple cubes down that has a bunch of Christian paraphernalia that's hanging all over it. And you're saying, no matter what, I do not want to be like that loser. I do not. You want to be original. You don't want to be like him or her. Or maybe you have great respect for your grandparents. They're wonderful people, read the Bible, went to church, yet you saw that they were racists. And so you're thinking, no, I can never have the same view of Jesus that they had. I got to be original. I got to mix in a little Hinduism, a little Eckhart Tolle, a little bit of fundamentalism, a little of this. We're trying to be original. Let's try in this journey to actually look at things that are plainly in sight. Sherlock Holmes and Watson went out camping one night under the stars, and Sherlock Holmes woke up in the middle of the night, woke up Watson. Watson! The stars, what do you think? Watson said, well, stars remind me of the universe, and the universe is of infinity. Infinity, and yet we are in a place that is finite. And yet with the universe, I can fathom the universe because I have a conscience. And the conscience, all of a sudden, Holmes interrupted him and said, no, you idiot. It means somebody stole our tent. That's what it means. And we sometimes try to get a little bit too innovative or creative instead of seeing what's plain right in front of us. I'm excited to be on this journey, and I know friends of mine are too. I have friends that need to have their image of Jesus reset. One of my friends was telling me that he's got stuff in his past that he's not been able to get over, and he just feels shame. Shame just drips all over him. And even though he's read the Bible, even though he's been baptized and a variety of things like that, he just can't shake this feeling of shame. And he knows that Jesus doesn't look at him that way, but yet he feels this. I have other people I know that feel like no matter what they do sexually, financially, occupationally, relationally, it's okay. Because Jesus is their buddy, and Jesus won't ever hold them accountable to anything. And so, therefore, they just do anything they want and feel like in the moment. And their image of Jesus needs to be reset. I'll talk a little bit about for myself, just a little brief bit of it right now. I struggle with feeling that God likes me. I struggle with the image of Jesus as a shepherd. I'll get into that a bit later. I need to have my image of Jesus reset. All of us have an image in here, no matter how informed, uninformed, accurate, or inaccurate it is. I'm asking all of us to go on this journey. We're going to look at the book of Luke. Luke chapter 1 I'm going to look at today. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are called the Gospels. Gospels means good news. And so I know that I need to have my image of Jesus reset when I feel like he's going to bring me bad news. That's just not the image of Jesus. Gospel means good news. And the first four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were written by people that were giving their account, their eyewitness testimony, or their testimony as they heard it from other people and writing it down. And here's what it says in the book of Luke, and we're going to read this. This entire book is going to be part of our journey, but I'm going to take a look at a couple little sections today. Here's what it says, Luke chapter 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. So Luke is saying, hey, there's a lot of people who have written stuff down, a lot of stories going on around there, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Luke was not one of the original 12 disciples of Jesus. He was close friends with them, was around with them. Specifically, he was around with the apostle Paul that authored most of the New Testament. And so what Luke, as a physician, as a very literate, studied guy, is deciding to do is to gather up all of these stories that have been happening, all of these things, and actually write these things down in the gospel according to Luke for Theophilus. He calls him most excellent. Some people think this is a sign of respect to somebody who must have been an official government official. You could also, though, look in the book of Acts, which Luke also wrote, and you'll find that he refers to a slimy official who's trying to figure out who Jesus is, a slimy person, as most excellent. And so it's very likely that he, in the Bible, refers to anybody who wants to be a seeker as most excellent. So I'll just tell you right now, if you're here today, it doesn't matter what you believe, what you agree, disagree with, if you're here today, God calls you most excellent. Excellent, excellent. You could be a lot of other places. You're here right now trying to dig in and understand the most important question in all of history. Was Jesus a fabrication? Was he actually the Son of God? Why is he known more than anybody who's ever lived? Why do have we dated time against him? When you're trying to figure this out, I believe God looks at you and says, most excellent. Way to go. Great, great, great job. One of the things that I want us to understand here today is that Jesus demands an examination. He demands examination. And there's a lot of soundbite beliefs that you might have had or heard of that's caused you to not examine Jesus. One of them is that there aren't any early written documents from eyewitnesses of Jesus. It was orally transmitted. And haven't we all played that game of telephone where you start on one side of the room, say something, it trickles all the way through, and in the end it says something totally different. So therefore, how can we trust that what we have about Jesus actually happened? Understand first, in the ancient world, we have very little that's ever written and recorded. The only thing we have written and recorded really was things that kings hired people to record that were their decrees. All ancient societies were orally transmitted. That's how they had their information. Judging them for not having a lot of early documentation would be like judging somebody in 1940 for not posting it on YouTube. Didn't exist. Wasn't part of the way it worked. And as a result, oral transmission of data was held in the highest esteem. People corrected one another. They held it as very, very important. But then finally, along came some people and said, hey, let's start actually writing this down. Now, we're going to take a look at our first video today of somebody who's examined some of this evidence. We're going to look at this throughout the entire series, people sharing their personal story or their journey of trying to determine truth. And while we take a look at this video, we're going to have some volunteers are going to come down and take up an offering. If you're new here today, no worries. We're just glad you're here. All you need to do is receive a book. Glad you have. For those who are part of this place, we know that our generosity fuels the infrastructure that makes this happen. 50 other churches are doing the exact same thing. This comes from our staff infrastructure that's written this. This offering fuels stuff in South Africa, here in our city. So that's why we're excited about being generous. So as we do that, let's take a look at what this guy says.
Whenever historians are assessing whether a document is trustworthy or not, there's a certain set of tests they apply to these documents. When you apply those same tests to the Gospels, they come out with flying colors. We discuss this a lot. My friend Paul Eddy and I discuss this a lot in our book, The Jesus Legend. But if you apply the Gospels to the same critical historical standards you apply to any other ancient document, whether it's written by Lucian or Suetonius or Tacitus or Livy or whoever, the Gospels just give us every reason to believe that they are generally trustworthy. They're not fabricated, they're not legend, they're passing on historically reliable information. For example, one of the tests is the test of detail. Records that reflect eyewitness reports tend to have superfluous detail in them, whereas fabricated accounts in the ancient world tend to lack that. Well, the Gospels are just full of this extraordinary, superfluous detail. Even more impressive, they're full of details that you'd think that they would have left out if the Gospels were being fabricated. I mean, for example, The way, you know, Jesus treats women and the fact that women are the ones to discover the tomb being empty. In first century Jewish culture, women were regarded as being untrustworthy. They weren't allowed to testify in court unless it was their witness was corroborated by a male. And yet the Gospels tell us that after Jesus was crucified, it was women who went to the tomb. Where are the guys? Well, the guys are scared and they're in hiding. It's the guys who are writing these documents, and it would be in their self-interest to leave that kind of information out. The fact that that kind of detail is included in the gospel really contributes to our confidence that they're passing on trustworthy information. And there's a number of other tests that we could go into as well. But by ordinary historical standards, the gospels come up with flying colors.
So can a rational person believe in Jesus? I hope so, because I consider myself a rational person and I believe in Jesus. I think the historical evidence for Jesus as a person is pretty compelling. I don't think there's a lot of controversy about that, although some people even argue about that. But I think for me, one of the really striking aspects of the story of Jesus has to do with his followers. And if you look at the biblical accounts, the different gospels, and certainly what happens in the book of Acts, there seems to have been this incredible transformation that these guys who were hanging out with Jesus were clearly all excited about what Jesus was teaching, and some of them must have thought that it was going to be a political coup or something that was going to happen. But then when he was arrested and basically tortured and ultimately killed, all these guys left. And it's pretty clear that they, whatever they thought Jesus was doing or whatever they thought he was, that they now had serious doubts about that, because it seemed like the game plan that they envisioned wasn't coming to play. I mean, it wasn't happening. Within the matter of really a couple days, where the account in Scripture is that Jesus came back from the dead, appeared to his disciples, to his followers, and then left the earth, something must have happened to convince these guys of the reality of not only what Jesus had said, but actually what he had accomplished, which was this coming through death and ultimately coming back to life, to the point where these guys went on to individually die for that faith. I think it's very hard to explain that other than there being something fundamentally profound, something so different about the experience of what they experienced in terms of their interaction with Jesus that convinced them of the reality of what he said about what he was doing and who he was. So I find that a pretty compelling line of evidence that something had happened that was way beyond the ordinary. I think you can accept that idea as a historical evidence for a particular event. But for me, it only takes on reality when we individually accept or turn to examining that claim for ourselves. And it was really only at that point in my life where I started examining that claim about who Jesus said he was and what it might mean that I then started realizing that actually has relevance to me today.
As we read this journey, it's likely that we say, "Oh, you know, how do I know that what's written here actually is what happened? I could disagree with what Jesus said, but how do I know that he actually said that?" Well, one of the things we do is we apply the same standards in determining authenticity with this book as you do with any ancient work of antiquity. And so let's take a look at some apples-to-apples comparisons of how this works in the scholarly world. If you have Plato, and he wrote his tetralogies, the date of those were somewhere between 427 and 347 BC. The earliest copy we have is 900 AD. There are no original copies of any of these things, as you're going to see. The time span between the original and the first one we actually have in our hands is 1,200 years. And the number of copies are 7. Actually, you would rather have multiple copies than the original. Why is that? Because if you have the original, you can always wonder, well, how do I know this is the original? There's only one. If this is the wrong one, then this could all be false. But if you have multiple copies, you can compare and contrast amongst them, ensuring that what you have is actually what would have been in the original. Another person you may have heard of, Aristotle, wrote stuff and was around from 384 to 322 BC. The earliest copy of his works is AD 1100. That's a time span of 1400 years from when he originally wrote to what we actually have in our hands. But there's 49 copies. And we're very confident when you read what was in Aristotle, what his works, we say, oh, this is what the guy believed. Somebody else, Homer, in the Iliad, 900 BC, the earliest copy we have is 400 BC. It's a 500-year span from when it was originally written to the first copy we actually have, and we have 643 copies. And nobody, having read the Iliad, ever says, well, how do I know that Homer really wrote this? I don't know if he did. No, you just examine it on its merits because we got 643 copies to compare and contrast, and they're pretty much all in alignment. Well, when we compare these same standards with the Gospels, we find the most liberal scholarship says 100 AD, the most scholarship says, conservative scholarship says 40 AD. The earliest copy we have is 150 AD of the fragment. Again, this is not all the different books in the New Testament. This is just those four Gospels. Time span of 75 years. And 5,500 copies. 5,500 copies. Virtually all in agreement except on some minor details. Let me tell you something. Nobody doubts whether or not Plato existed. Nobody has these interesting philosophical discussions after having had four beers whether or not Aristotle actually was a living physical being. Nobody goes to English classes and picks apart Homer and defames his work like, oh, we have no original. Nobody, it's a given. Yet when it comes to Jesus, when it comes to Gospels, all of a sudden we play a different game and we all of a sudden come coming down on him. And in doing so, we are committing intellectual and scholarly suicide. These are the numbers. They're not fabricated. It's there. So if we don't want to trust that we have an accurate record, let's be consistent and not trust anything we've heard about Plato, Homer, Aristotle. And by the way, you could do this with any ancient antiquity, any. But I just didn't pick three that were sort of bad ones. These are the best ones, any of them. Some of us need to reset our assumptions that you're checking your brain at the door by actually reading and believing that was actually in the Bible, actually is a part of history. Not only this, there are corroborating historians from the first, second, third centuries that were not Christians that can verify that there was a guy, Jesus, who actually walked around and did amazing things. People like Pliny, Tacitus, Josephus, Lucian, Thallus. None of these people were Christ followers or believers and readers in the Bible, yet all of them mention Jesus, talk about him as being a historical figure. In fact, one of them, another one, his name is Celsus. His brother's name was Fahrenheit. Celsus was an early Neoplatonist. Neo, Plato, meant he was sort of a newer, more contemporary version of Platonic philosophy. And he wrote a work called True Doctrine, in which he comes down on Jesus, and he comes down on him in a way in which he says that the reason he was able to do his miracles was because he was tapping into witchcraft. He was tapping into sorcery. This actually was the same accusation that the religious leaders of Jesus' time used that we'll find recorded in the Bible. It's very fascinating that Celsus, or none of these early historians, by the way, none of them deny that Jesus existed. None of them deny that he did miracles. They deny that he was the Son of God. They deny that he got his power from God. They'll instead say it was sorcery. It was witchcraft. Other historians that don't have a Christian persuasion are important to look at. Some people would say, well, Jesus, he's hard to really believe in because he follows the myth paradigm. Joseph Campbell wrote a fascinating book a number of years ago called The Hero with Many Faces, in which in this book he talks about how heroes undergo a similar paradigm. There's a pattern to them. They're kind of outsiders. They come inside. They leave to get educated. They come back. They do heroic things. They lose their life. There's a variety of things that the pattern is followed that you could see with Beowulf. You can see with Achilles. You can see with Jesus. You can also see this with Abraham Lincoln. Just because this paradigm goes doesn't mean the person wasn't an actual historical figure. In fact, while some people argue that this shows that Jesus was mythical, he was a legend, people were making stuff up, I think it's more interesting to say, why is it that every single society, every culture, all over the world, have myths or legends that they believe in that follows a similar pattern? Why is that? I believe it's because all of us are created in the image of God. We have the story of God planted in our heart. We have a longing for a reality that we may not have seen or personally experienced, but we naturally tell tales and make stories that tap into our psyche, because all of us, I believe, whether or not we know it or not and understand it or not, have the gospel story, the good news story of Jesus planted in us. We just may not have known it or been exposed to it, but we have this longing for the story of Jesus that actually, I believe, happened. So says a friend of mine, Greg. Let's take a look at what he says.
The reason I believe that Jesus is the ultimate revelation of that God, a lot of it has to do with all the historical evidence that supports the general reliability of the Gospels and other evidence that really in various ways supports his existence and things of that sort. But on top of that, there's this. Anyone who believes that there is any point to life, or at least suspects there might be a point to life, if they're at all healthy, they know it has something to do with love. It has something to do with love. That's just a kind of a core, basic human intuition. The point is about love. The Gospels, if you understand them, the story of Jesus, if you understand them rightly, represent the greatest love story ever told. Because it's the story of an all-holy, omnipotent God becoming a human being and dying a God-forsaken, hellish death on the cross out of love for a people who could deserve it less. It's the greatest love story ever told, because you couldn't have a love story where a lover crossed a greater distance and made a greater sacrifice for a beloved who deserved it less. The incongruity is the poignancy of this story. And by that criteria, this is the greatest love story ever told. And so when you read, even apart from all the historical evidence, if you understand the gospel story, there's something inside of us that goes yes to it. At the very least, we want that to be true. There's something that says that ought to be true. In Jesus, we find the deepest intuitions of our greatest myths incarnated, and we have every reason to believe that they're true. And that not only satisfies the heart, but it satisfies the head. Here we have a worldview centered on Jesus Christ that we can live with, that has the power to transform our life and give meaning to our life. And there's a deep, deep part of our inner intuition that says yes to it, on top of all the historical evidence we have for believing it's true.
You know, if there's a God, wouldn't he want to be clear? And how better to be clear than to actually come and live amongst us? This is what Jesus says of himself in one amongst many places, John chapter 14, verse 7, when Jesus says this. He says, "If you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." You want to know what God's like? You want to know how God loves? You want to know what God's character is? Right here. Right here, making it crystal clear for you. People believe, many people believe, that the reason why God chose this time period is because Rome was the power center of the whole world, and the entire power center of the whole world was concentrated in one region. That's never happened before or since in human history. And this is the time period and the place where God came and crashed into the world. This is one of the theories that's there. Not only does Jesus demand examination, but when we do examine him, he actually defies expectations. Jesus defies expectations. What we see in the book of Luke and all the different books in the Bible is we have some detail around when Jesus was conceived and born. There's some stuff there. We have much more detail when Jesus was 30, when he actually came out and declared himself, taught, did amazing things, and died around age 33. But there's this massive gap from birth to age 30 where we know virtually nothing. It's pretty much conjecture, except for one story that you can read and you will read, but I'm going to talk about it in a moment, in the book of Luke, chapter 2. Background of this is the high holy holiday of Jews still to this day is Passover. And at that time and in that period of the world, you would go to Jerusalem to celebrate the high holy day of Passover, the high holy holiday of Passover. And so all the Jews from different towns would caravan together, and they would all kind of show up for this incredible worship experience, party experience, community bonding experience. And after a few days, it's time to leave. And as they take off in caravans, Jesus gets left behind. How many of us have ever been left behind at a mall? Anybody? How many of us have ever been like lost by our parents? I mean, I remember I got lost at a mall and I wandered into some shoe store and I said, I was all completely beside myself. That was a pretty good crying face, wasn't it? I was all crying and boo-hoo, and then went out in the loudspeaker and said, Brian Tomb is here at Kenny Shoes. Would Mrs. Do they still have Kenny Shoes? I'm getting old. I'm getting very old. My parents came. My mom came. Everything was fine. Jesus has that similar reaction. Actually, he's not boo-hooing like I was. It looks like he's pretty happy, but his parents are boo-hooing. His parents are freaked out. They get home. Now, that doesn't mean they're bad parents, by the way. Back then, they did believe in many ways it took a village to raise a child. And so as you were caravanning, your kids were playing with other kids and families were hanging out in this long caravan, and they just probably assumed that Jesus was hanging out with Harry and Stella Schwartz's kid, hanging out with Joachim like he always did, shot marbles with Joachim, and just assumed that he was kind of in the caravan. They get home and realize, oh no, where's Jesus? We left them back in Jerusalem. They hightail it back to Jerusalem, and they find that Jesus is hanging out in the synagogue in this worship experience. He's actually contributing to the discussion at age 12, and here's what happens. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." "Why are you searching for me?" he asked. "Didn't you know that I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Now, this is, to me, is very interesting. A lot of us, we're a little bitter that we haven't had these miraculous experiences like Mary and Joseph. And they got visited by angels in the early stages. They saw visions. And some of us are like, you know, if I just saw that stuff, then I would believe, then I would know without a shadow of a doubt. Hey, guess what? Mary and Joseph saw that, and guess what? They forgot it. They lost the plot. They had an angel come and say, "This is what's going to happen with your son. Here's the way it's going to work." And somehow over 12 years, they've lost the whole point of their lives as parents. Guess what? Mary and Joseph had to hit the reset button. If they had to hit the reset button, you think that you don't, just admit you're prideful and are clueless. Just admit it. Come on. Come on. They were living with God. They had visions, and they've lost hope on Jesus going, why are you searching for me? Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house? Don't you remember? Don't you remember? See, but he's defying their expectations. They thought, as time went on, that their expectation was this going to be a nice little boy who would never disappoint them and who would never cause them confusion. Jesus will defy your expectations the more you understand and the more you get to know him. This is why we'll just constantly recreate things, because we don't like certain things. You know, when you read the Gospels, understand that everybody who writes those things are emotionally involved. Some of the criticism that comes against them is that, well, you can't trust them because the people who wrote them, they had a stake in it and they were emotionally involved. Hey, if that's the case, we should believe nothing about the Holocaust, because the Holocaust came to us originally by people who were emotionally involved. In fact, even today, there's a lot of us in here, maybe you've never read anything on the Holocaust, but in terms of oral transmission, you understand it. And in fact, if you say it doesn't exist, what happens? You get fired. You get fired. And yet, this was all coming initially from people who were emotionally involved. Hey, if you're reading about Jesus or writing about Jesus in the early days, of course you're emotionally involved. You saw people healed. You saw people who were blind seeing. You saw people coming back from the dead. You saw somebody who got beaten to a bloody pulp still extending love. You were very emotionally involved, but it doesn't mean that you still couldn't accurately recount history. Part of what happens with scholars today is none of the scholars are ever honest, because none of us are purely objective. None of us are. All of us have stuff that taints how we approach a topic. It's just you're never honest about it. You never are. You know, and all scholars want to be original and they want to pretend like they're objective and they're right. Whether they're Borg or Chilton or MacArthur or Funk or Crossan or whoever it is, liberal, conservative, everyone wants to pretend like they just observe the fact. And no, it never works out that way. We're all tainted by something that's touched our experience. So if you've had a bad, abusive relationship with Christianity or with church, of course you're going to find things to debunk Jesus and come against it, all the while pretending to be objective. Anne Rice, I would call her a scholar of Vampire Chronicles fame. She specializes in historical novels, especially those that are of ancient periods. And she wrote an historical novel. It's pure conjecture because we don't know all that much about Jesus, again, from birth to 30. But she writes this novel called Christ Our Lord Out of Egypt, in which she wants to talk about that. And the interesting thing in this novel is at the end of her book, she has a section all about herself, which I think is awesome. I think every scholar who pretends to be objective would just tell us their story so we can know where they're coming from. She does this. She talks about how she's married to an atheist, how she became atheist / agnostic about 30 years. Other interviews I've seen, she says part of that was because she has a gay son, and she felt the church she was a part of was incredibly violent, shameful, judgmental, shunning, and so she had a vested interest to debunk and come against Jesus, and she carried that with her for a long time. She's very, I love that. And then what she does, she digs into this research because God starts working on her heart, according to her. But at the end of her book, and I haven't read all the novel, but I've read this last section of this novel, and I want to excerpt a bit of this for you. Here's what she says as she decides to do work to figure out who Jesus was and looking at documentary evidence. She says this, "And what would I write about my Jesus?" This is a long quote, so hang in there. "And what would I write about my Jesus? I had no idea, but the prospects were interesting. Surely he was a liberal, married, had children, was a homosexual, and who knew what? But I must do my research before I wrote one word. These skeptical scholars seem so very sure of themselves. They built their books on certain assertions without even examining these assertions. What gradually became clear to me was that many of the skeptical arguments that insisted most of the Gospels were suspect, for instance, or written too late to be eyewitness accounts, lacked coherence. They were not elegant. Arguments about Jesus himself were full of conjecture. Some books were no more than assumptions piled upon assumptions. Absurd conclusions were reached on the basis of little or no data at all. In sum, the whole case for the non-divine Jesus, who stumbled into Jerusalem and somehow got crucified by nobody and had nothing to do with the founding of Christianity and will be horrified by it if he knew about it, that whole picture by which had floated in the liberal circles I frequented as an atheist for 30 years, that case was not made. Not only was it not made, I discovered in this field, some of the worst and most biased scholarship I'd ever read. I saw almost no skeptical scholarship that was convincing, and the Gospels, shredded by critics, lost all intensity when reconstructed by various theorists. They were in no way compelling when treated as composites and records of later communities." Why is this? Why is so much study, so much controversy? Part of it is what Jesus said about himself that we'll read in Luke. When Jesus says this, he says, "Do you think that I came to bring peace on earth? No, I tell you, but division." Jesus doesn't say, "Hey, my goal is to be divisive." Jesus says, "I'm coming here and I'm going to be so crystal clear, you're going to have to react. I'm not going to allow this, hey, all truth is equal and your truth is my truth. That's okay. Let's all live in peace with all of our different truths." He says, "I'm going to come, I'm going to make bold, bold statements that if you understand and take them at face value, because that's the way I'm giving you, they're going to force you to make a decision, and therefore there will be division over who I am." He says this about himself long before any scholars come along. And Anne Rice continues, "Many of these scholars who apparently devoted their life to New Testament scholarship, disliked Jesus Christ. Some pitied him as a hopeless failure. Others sneered at him, and some felt an outright contempt. This came between the lines of the books. This emerged in the personality of the texts. I'd never come across this kind of emotion in any other field of research, at least not to this extent. It was puzzling. The people who went into Elizabethan studies don't set out to prove that Queen Elizabeth I was a fool. They don't personally dislike her. They don't make snickering remarks about her, spend their careers trying to pick apart her historical reputation. And yet, books that are published today or stuff that's on TV, I mean, we got to be original and we got to do something different. So let's just throw out all analytical study of integrity, in part because Jesus defies our expectations. He doesn't let us off the hook with things that we think are a done deal. I needed this last week to go through all that old documentary evidence. I haven't done that for a while. It was good. It was healthy for me to go through that. I needed that. It's good for me to get regrounded that I'm not checking my brain at the door. But emotionally, I need this journey very, very badly. I need to hit the reset button on some stuff for myself. People come up to me sometimes and they'll say, man, you know, God must be really blessing you. He's really blessing you. And sometimes someone will say that to me, and the backdrop to that comment is because you're a part of Crossroads. It's a big growing thing. Look at this in your family. Looks like you got good kids. You got this happening good. You got this. You know, things are going. God's really blessing you. And internally, what I immediately feel when someone says that is not necessarily. Not necessarily. Now, the reason I think that immediately is part of that is an intellectual truth. There's a lot of things that are big, growing, that have nothing to do with God at all. It's just a matter of being disciplined and doing the right things. A lot of atheists have great, big, wonderful things that are happening. It doesn't mean God's blessing them. He might be. It could just be exhibiting the gifts that God has given and working it hard. So just because I'm part of something that's big and cool and going well doesn't necessarily mean that. I understand that intellectually, okay? But at the same time, emotionally, I should give God more credit than I do intentionally. And the reason that is not because I'm trying to hog glory for myself. It's because I oftentimes feel guilty about the good things I have in my life. I feel like I'm not worthy. Maybe this is because I have some adoption stuff happening. Maybe this is because my early Christian community I was a part of really majored on Jesus as the judgmental figure who kind of came down on people and gave the truth and let people have. And there's certainly times that he does do that, but maybe it was because I had a massive dose of that. But for whatever reason, Jesus is a shepherd. Yes, I understand that intellectually that Jesus likens himself to a shepherd, but emotionally, I don't feel that very often. When I do feel that is when I'm absolutely beaten down, when something awful has happened, and then I do feel that. I feel that. Maybe I feel that because I have the sick part of me that goes, okay, good, something bad just happened to me. God's justice just came to me. Now it won't happen for a while, so I can start feeling better. Because it'll be a while until he comes and flaps from the back of the head again. I know intellectually that Jesus is a shepherd. I know intellectually that Jesus is for me. I know that. I could answer that right in seminary. But I'm saying emotionally, I still struggle with this. I'm not sure that he's really for me when things are going well. And that's why I need this journey. I need to hit the reset button because some things that I feel, that just because I feel aren't right. And I know that that is not right. All of us have things. I promise you and guarantee you, you have things in here that need to be reset. We all need this journey. And therefore, we're going to experiment. We're going to try things. Jesus deserves experimentation. Deserves experimentation. Eventually, you have to get beyond criticizing. You have to get beyond reading. You have to get beyond philosophizing to actually trying and experimenting with what he actually said to do. You have to try eventually experimenting with praying for enemies. Try, instead of philosophizing about, actually experiment with it. We're going to do that. We're going to be doing things like singing and experimenting. We're going to be doing things like going on prayer experiences and experimenting with prayer as opposed to just analyzing it. That's why a small group experience is critical because we're going to get in small groups. And we are going to experiment with what it means to sharpen one another and be in a small community for 6 weeks. That's what, after all, Jesus was in a small community for a few years. It's called the 12 disciples, and we're going to experiment with that. And yes, Jesus was around annoying people in his community, and you'll be around some annoying people probably in your small group as well. But it's only 6 weeks long, and even then, you will learn things and be sharpened spiritually. We're going to experiment, and while we experiment, we're going to experience things, I believe, that we've never experienced before, things that are deeper, things that are beyond, and that's what I'm praying, God. I'm praying for a deeper thing. I'm praying for a deeper thing. I'm praying for the reset button. I'm praying for an awareness. I'm praying for an overwhelming sense of peace and confidence for myself and for all those connected with Crossroads or connected with the other 50 churches. Bring us to the deeper things. Why don't we stand? Let's stand and continue on the experimental process right now with these words that you might understand or might not understand, but let's experiment. There is a hope that resides in wrapping your mind around, wait, God actually came here to earth, perhaps, and actually came to give me hope that transcends the hope for a better economy that may never happen again. Not to bum you out, but it's a pretty intriguing idea we're looking at. Okay, now, doesn't matter where you are right now. We'll see where we are in 6 weeks. But I want to encourage us all to do is concentrate. I don't know if you've been following this whole hubbub with Barack Obama and his BlackBerry. Yes, he is. A lot of us can, we have our first American president we can relate to because he's African American. Others of us say that's the first president I can relate to because he's actually using a BlackBerry. Actually, really, first one to use that, if you use a BlackBerry or an iPhone or a Trio, whatever it is. Now, this is actually controversial, very controversial, because those of us who have a device like that go, oh, I don't know if that's a good idea, because this just fuels ADD. It fuels a lack of concentration. You know, you're in a meeting, and you'll say, oh, I gotta get this. You know, I'm not sure if I want somebody who's trying to, like, figure out nuclear weapons to be at the beck and call of a BlackBerry. I'm not sure that works all that well together. The danger with our society and some of the technology that we all have is that very few of us ever concentrate anymore. Just concentrate. And we're going to do it for 6 weeks. I want you to concentrate. This journey is created for full concentration. Make that happen. Do yourself a favor. And if you're not sure where you're going to get the time, hey, don't work out for 6 weeks if you can't do both. Allow yourself to gain weight for 6 weeks. If you know, the only downtime you have for 6 weeks is when you watch Lost, well, hey, DVR Lost. Catch up with it in 6 weeks. Do whatever you can to concentrate on this. This is worthy of huge, huge concentration. So there's a way for us to get in groups. If you're touched and you want someone to pray for you, just hang out where you are, and our prayer folks will come to the auditorium. But for the rest of us, hey, let's go. Get in a group. Get your kids. Get out of here. The journey's begun.